This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of May 13th, 2019. I'm Mason King. Electric scooters blew into town in June of 2018, and it was kind of like the Wild West if you replaced the horses and the tumbleweeds with scooters. Scooter company Bird showed up first, dropping hundreds of scooters downtown and a few other pedestrian heavy areas. Bird competitor Lime showed up with its own scooters days later. Now, for those who haven't used them, the proposition here is pretty simple. You unlock the scooter with a smartphone app, which is hooked up to your bank account. You ride the scooter to your destination and then leave it there for someone else to use. Scooter companies retrieve them at night, recharge them, and then redistribute them to places where they know they'll get used the next day. Now, city officials in Indianapolis were caught off guard by this and tried to step in quickly last year with an official application process and some basic regulations. They continued working on a second wave of rules that were approved on Friday morning. Now, for the most part, the scooters right now are concentrated in popular, commerce, and pedestrian-friendly areas, essentially the Mile Square of downtown, the Mass Ave District, and Fountain Square. Now, the city wanted to make sure a much broader swath of the population could use them as well. They proposed that a set percentage of scooters be distributed to what they call access zones. Now, here's Sonia Cedar, administrator of License and Permit Services, with an explanation.
So the rationale is that we want scooters to be used. That's the whole purpose of this regulation. But we want to make sure that they're available to a broad variety of people to use. We don't want the downtown area to be so oversaturated that it's only for people to come and play. We really want to see the companies expand upon their mission of providing last mile transportation. So the overall mission of the access zone is to make sure that scooters are available to everyone in Indianapolis, especially in places where there is close access to BRT lines and where there's a greater dependence on non-automobile forms of transportation.
IBJ's Haley Colombo has been following the advent of scooters in Indianapolis since the Wild West days, and she is back in the podcast studio to help us get up to speed. Haley, how are you?
I am great.
Great.
I did not get here on a scooter. I just walked into the podcast studio.
Have you done a scooter?
I have not ridden a scooter.
I haven't scooted either.
And we asked Mayor Hogsett if he had ridden one several months ago, and he said he has not either. I don't know if that's changed.
The reason why I haven't is because I'm old. What's your excuse?
I'm extremely uncoordinated and accident prone, and it just feels like it would be a bad idea. I don't know. I'm also never wearing the right shoes for something like that.
Well, let's start with a quick census of the scooter companies. What companies have permits to operate in Indianapolis? Which ones already have scooters on the ground?
So I realized the other day that all of these scooter companies have very similar sort of four-letter word names. So we have, so far we have Bird, Lime, Spin, and Lyft. And the Pacers Bike Share also has a license to have dockless bikes at some point, although they don't necessarily, my understanding is they don't necessarily like have immediate plans to do so. They essentially, I think, just got a license to get one.
Oh, this would be in addition to the bike share program, which they have.
Right.
Which is docked.
Docked. Yeah. Yes. So we have four scooter companies. Lyft is about to launch here. If they haven't already, they recently got approved by the city. And as you said, it was very much a Wild West situation where the scooters were just sort of going crazy until the city approved some regulations to sort of say, hey, we, you know, want people to be riding on the streets. We want people to be, you know, wearing helmets. We want there to be a way to track these things. And it's calmed down a little bit since then, but still, you know, now that the weather has been getting nicer, the scooters are really back in full force, and I'm sure throughout the summer we'll see them still in full force.
Lime and Bird have scooters on the ground. Spin and Lyft, I think, should be ready to go here in a few weeks. Do we have a sense of how many Bird and Lime have right now?
At the height of the scooter craze last year, my understanding is that the city said that it was about 5,000.
Holy smokes.
So, yeah, didn't it seem like, it seemed like more than that almost.
Yeah.
So the rules that were approved today essentially set the max at 1,000 devices per operator. And that can go up and down based on how often those scooters are actually used. So the city has said that they don't think these new rules will necessarily impact the amount of scooters that will feel on the ground, because they were essentially approving rules that were, I think, sort of status quo rules.
But if I'm if I get that last license and it's King Scooter, because it's got four letters, and I have 1,000 scooters, but the stats are showing that my scooters are not being used, according to these regulations, I would have to pull back.
Exactly. They've come up with an equation to calculate how many scooters you can have out at one time. It essentially is sort of a average daily rides calculation per device taken over an entire month. So it could be on some months that there are maybe special events in town or something like that. Some of these scooter companies could petition to get more scooters. And then if things are really slow, they would have to pare down. So it should be really interesting to see how this goes. And if we, as just pedestrians and, you know, residents of the city, if we feel any sort of change in how many scooters there are.
Now, some cities have made the connection that if they're regulating these things and these companies are claiming that they're valuable for need-based transportation, that they're really, you know, doing a service for the community, maybe that they should make sure they're accessible to residents who need more transportation options. And why is that?
I think scooters have been proven to be, you know, great fun for people, for tourists, for people, you know, going back and forth to restaurants and entertainment. But that's not necessarily what the scooters have billed themselves as. They've billed themselves as, we can help people get around the city to all the places they need to go, whether that's work, school, to the store, run errands, that sort of thing. And the city is saying, so your service, you know, uses our assets. So we are saying now we want you guys to make good on that promise that it's about providing valuable transportation options.
So how would this work in Indianapolis? What would it look like?
The rules that were approved today state that scooter companies can have no less than 10% of their devices in these certain access zones. And essentially, these zones encapsulate a lot of the city, actually. A lot of maybe underrepresented or low and moderate income neighborhoods, like the far northwest side, the far east side, the near west side, parts of Butler Tarkington, parts of Mapleton Fall Creek, parts of Martindale Brightwood. Yeah, so a lot of areas of the city.
Is this something that the Department of Business and Neighborhood Services kind of cooked up on its own? Or is this based on something that they found somewhere else?
So they worked with the Department of Metropolitan Development to come up with what these areas would be. And I asked the DMD essentially how they defined this. And they do sort of follow neighborhood boundaries, but they said they analyzed a wide variety of factors, like where car ownership was low and where, you know, bus rapid transit lines will eventually go.
So it's a minimum of 10% of your scooters.
Yes.
So let's say we have all five scooter spots are filled with companies. They each have the max. They each have 1,000. So that would be minimum 500 scooters.
Well, if there is another scooter license given out, I guess.
Yeah, if there's a fifth license given out.
Right.
So could be 500.
That's true, yeah. No. It will be really interesting to see how scooter companies deploy these in these neighborhoods. You know, some things that might make sense are they, you know, put around Blue Indy stations? It could be around, you know, commercial nodes, that sort of thing. It'll be very interesting.
Hey, this is a good time to take a break. You're listening to the IBJ Podcast.
The IBJ Podcast is sponsored by Nimbo IP, Indiana's top cloud solutions provider for voice, data, IT, and network security. Nimbo IP has proudly served Hoosier businesses since 1989. Let its innovative solutions put your business on the right path plan, and platform for the future. Nimbo IP has been named one of America's best VoIP providers by Enterprise Networking Magazine. Call them today for a complimentary technology assessment at 317-574-1000 or visit them on the web at www.nimboip.com. Nimbo IP, your solutions in the cloud.
Okay, we're back with the IBJ podcast. I'm Mason King, and with me is IBJ reporter Haley Colombo. We're talking about new regulations for scooter companies that Indianapolis just approved that are designed to bring scooters to parts of the city that don't currently have them. Now, the question that was in my mind over the break was, in terms of helping people who lack transportation options, giving them a real solution to getting around, how big of an impact could this possibly have? I mean, we're talking 500 to 1,000 scooters.
I think scooters are something that could be really useful for a certain part of the population and not useful at all to another part of the population. So if you think about just a single person who needs to get to work or needs to get to a bus stop, and the bus stop is maybe a mile away from their house, and there was a scooter, you know, at their apartment complex, could they come downstairs, take the scooter to the bus stop, get on the bus, and go on their way to work and have that be, you know, instead of walking a mile, have that be a little bit of an easier time for them? So you could see that working out. But you could also see maybe a single mom who has to drop her child off at daycare first before she goes into work. You know, if you have a kid in a stroller or if you're carrying your child, there's no way that a scooter would be useful at all to you. Although, popping in to just say that I did see someone pushing a stroller and riding one of these scooters downtown once, and it was, I just, one of those things where you just want to cover your eyes. So yeah, it's not going to be of use to someone, you know, with multiple people in their family, or someone who is disabled is not going to maybe be able to ride a scooter, or maybe someone who's older and doesn't necessarily feel comfortable. Obviously, they're not meant to be used for long distances. So I was talking with some folks who really care about the people's mobility challenges here. They form this personal mobility network. It's folks from Indigo. It's other transportation advocates here, who Central Indiana Community Foundation, folks who are trying to figure out transit issues. And I was talking with Ron Gifford, who's in charge of that group, and he was sort of saying that the scooters could be useful for it, sort of a niche part of the population, but this is not a panacea for last mile transportation.
What are the scooter companies saying about these regulations?
They didn't say much of anything today. Only two of the companies spoke. Bird and Lime both spoke. Bird seemed to be in favor of them, or spoke in favor of them, and said that putting scooters in the access areas would allow them to reach more customers. And then Lime, they spoke, a representative spoke, but they didn't really address the issue at hand at all. So no one seemed to put up a big fuss about it. These scooter companies have had to deal with, you know, regulations in so many different metropolitan areas or municipalities. And so, you know, they're dealing with regulatory issues all over the country. Apparently, these did not seem to be too onerous for them because they were very they were fine with it.
Yeah, they did seem pretty amenable. Yeah.
Yes.
At the hearing today, where the board of, help me out with the board.
The board of the Department of Business and Neighborhood Services, which was formerly known as Code Enforcement. So, yeah.
Where they approved the regulations. As I was sitting there, I saw a couple of problems. And the first is reliability. I was thinking, well, if I live in Martindale Brightwood, for example, and I want to be able to take a scooter to work every day, I mean, how do I know the scooter is going to be there
every day? That's what I think, too. I'm sure folks listening to this podcast will be like, here's how Dockless works. And, you know, will maybe explain to us and send us emails explaining this to us or something. But to me, I'm just thinking about my own personal experience with transportation. The reason why bus stops make sense is because there's a stop. It's not like you're just walking along the side of the road and the bus, like, maybe sees you and picks you up, you go to the bus stop that's closest to you, and you know that the bus will stop there at a certain time. And then you go to another stop that is, you know. So I think on the back end, it's on the back end, the dockless is awesome, right? If you think about, I can just drop this wherever I'm going. I don't have to look for a block away. Is there a dock? Where can I put it? You know, on the front end, I don't understand it. Like, I definitely understand it downtown. Like, we could exit the IBJ offices right now and probably spot a scooter just within, you know.
Oh, within 10 feet.
Within 10 feet, yeah, just we could see one. But if I am living in a neighborhood that is perhaps not as loaded with scooters, do I see one regularly? And if you don't see one regularly, is it a really accessible option?
I posed this question to Sonia while you're writing your story today. And here's what she had to say about it. Whereas if I am someone who lives in one of the zones and I decide that I would like to have, I would like to take a scooter to work every day, how do I know that it's going to be there every day?
So you don't necessarily, right? The companies, I don't want to speak for them, but they can kind of fine tune who's using them and where they need to be. We are hoping that by providing these access zones, the company will sort of figure out where the hot spots in the access zones are and make sure there are reliably scooters there. I can tell you that right now there is a company who puts scooters outside of our office, but they aren't always reliably there, so I don't rely on them as a form of transportation. If you know they're going to be there every day, they'll get used.
Mm-hmm. But it's up to the company to make sure that happens.
It is, yes.
Do I have a guarantee as somebody who wants to use this as my daily form of transportation that it will be available?
No.
So can I talk to the company and I ask them, can you please make sure there's a scooter here?
Yes. Mm-hmm. People can absolutely do that. And I don't want to speak for the companies too much, but one thing that they've told me that I think is fascinating is that if you go through and you open up one of their apps just to see where scooters are, and you do it enough from the same location, they will actually start dropping scooters near you.
So that was interesting to me. I mean, it sounds like on one hand, it's kind of a, you know, the market will take care of itself kind of solution.
Yeah. It's imposing rules on the market because the market isn't serving all residents and then saying that the market will just take care of those residents.
I was sitting there trying to figure out how to say that, and that is exactly what I was thinking.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're having it both ways. Another thing that occurred to me is these cost money. You know, you need to have the dollar to get the thing moving, and then the pennies on the minute that you have to pay. And residents don't have any power, I don't know, over whether or not the rates go up or not.
I think one of the issues is it may be easy to, you know, have some cash to get on the bus, but do you have a credit card hooked up to your smartphone? Like, so many people have smartphones. They're not necessarily this thing that's reserved for the rich and powerful. You know, there are actual statistics on this. I don't have this off the top of my head, but folks I've spoken to have said people who are poor have smartphones. The issue is, do they have data on their you know, do they have data on your phone to allow you to, like, use the app and everything?
Mm-hmm. And you brought up a question that I asked Sonia, actually, which is about whether or not you have access, your phone can access your bank account.
Yes.
Every single one of the companies that we've licensed offers some sort of program. So you heard today about Lime Access and Bird Access. Spin and Lyft also offer similar programs. Much like a prepaid credit card, there are opportunities there for people who don't have a smartphone, don't have a bank account, to still access scooters.
So I thought that was interesting. I wasn't aware that that kind of option was available.
One thing I thought was interesting was, I think the Lime person was talking about this at the meeting, saying they have this Lime Access program and it's for low income, you know, folks, and they only have to pay so much. And one of the board members, Anthony Bridgman, said, you know, how do you promote that service? And I think it was sort of like this slightly tense back and forth of, you know, how do people in neighborhoods know that you have an affordable service for them if you're not really out promoting or doing community outreach to those neighborhoods? And I think the members of the board today pressed the scooter companies a couple times on doing community outreach, because is something really accessible if you don't know that it's accessible?
And I got the impression they also were asking Sonia about the city's plans to let residents in these access neighborhoods know that this was going to be available.
Yes. I was speaking with one community activist, Wildstyle, who is a music producer. He's a CICF community ambassador. And he was saying a lot of the older, longtime homeowners, maybe senior citizens in neighborhoods, they're going to see these things pop up and be, you know, on their lawns and be like, what is going on with this? Like, they're not going to see it as like something that's for them. So I do think having a lot of community outreach to say like what it is these things can do. And here's, you know, it says what the prices are on here, but you might not necessarily have to pay that price. You know, you might be able to pay less. I mean, it's one of these interesting things about these scooter companies is that, you know, they essentially showed up, right? When they first showed up, it was sort of like they just dropped in and you sort of had to make your own sense out of them. And will they appear in these neighborhoods in the same way?
So what comes next? I mean, are these regulations immediately applicable, or do we have to wait a while?
They will go into effect in mid-June, is my understanding.
All right. Well, let's see. Let's set a date. Let's talk about this in September.
Okay. That sounds good.
Haley, thank you so much.
Thank you.
My thanks again to Haley. Hey, before you get on with your week, I want to draw your attention to a story on the front page of this week's edition of IBJ. Steak and Shake has been a mainstay in Indianapolis and in the Midwest for many decades, but recent results at the burger chain are not encouraging. It's operating at a loss, and customer traffic counts are in a tailspin. It has temporarily closed 60 company-owned restaurants, and efforts to transition them to franchisees are dragging. Shareholders are unhappy with the CEO of the chain's parent company for what they consider to be dubious expenses. IBJ editor Greg Andrews examines the signs that Steak and Shake is slipping into very dangerous territory. Again, you can find this story in the copy of IBJ that you have delivered to your home or office, and at IBJ.com as well. And to get unfettered access to all of IBJ's award-winning business content, just hit the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King, and we'll be back again next week.